Can I invite the speakers to come up and sit at the panel? And I'd just like to read their bios. First, we'll have Shamal Idris, who is the Deputy Director at the UN Office of the Alliance of Civilizations. Mr. Idris was Senior Advisor for Islamic Western Relations Programs for the International Conflict Resolution Organization, Search for Common Ground. He serves on the Coordinating Committee and the Secretariat of the World Economic Forum's Council of 100 Leaders, which convenes political, corporate, religious, and academic leaders from predominantly Muslim countries, the United States, and Western Europe to initiate projects that foster Islamic Western understanding. Prior to his current position, Mr. Idris served as SFCG's Chief Operating Officer from 2000 to 2004, managing the organization's global operations and its headquarters in Washington, D.C. He coordinated some of the first projects under SFCG's United States-Iran Initiative, an effort to improve American-Iranian relations that started with facilitation of the first public visit of Americans to Iran since the 1979 revolution, the American National Wrestling Team's visit to Tehran in 1999. From 1999 to 2000, he served as director of SFCG's Burundi program, managing projects of Hutu-Tutsi ethnic cooperation, including the first independent multi-ethnic radio outlet in Burundi, Studio Ijambo. Mr. Idris sits on the boards of the Alliance for International Conflict Prevention and Resolution, SALIA, and the Arab West Skills Summit. He has conducted mediations for the Washington, D.C. Department of Human Rights and Minority Business Development, and has facilitated workshops with prison inmates on alternatives to violence in conflict management. Mr. Idris has published articles in German, South African, Arab, and American journals and newspapers. Next, we'll have Sasha Mira, who is the deputy to the senior advisor to the Secretary of State for Women's Empowerment. The office was newly created by Secretary Rice to help facilitate women's empowerment worldwide, with a special focus on Muslim women. Prior to joining this office, Ms. Mira worked at the State Department's Bureau of International Organization Affairs, where she specialized in human rights and democracy promotion. Ms. Mira is also an adjunct professor of international law at American University. She has a BA in international relations from Johns Hopkins University and a JD from American University's Washington College of Law. Next, we'll have Jin In, who has been empowering women and girls for over 11 years. She is the new Global Action Manager at Girl Scouts of the USA. In this capacity, she brings girl voices to the global stage and builds partnerships with 144 member associations of the World Association of Girl Guides and Girl Scouts and UN agencies. Prior to GSUSA, she was at the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services Office on Women's Health, where she served as a girls' health advisor to national and global initiatives, such as Healthy People 2010 and World AIDS Day. As a champion for girls, she successfully obtained approximately $1 million of congressional funding for the first federal website for girls, by girls, as well as developed HHS and executive branch-wide partnerships. Additionally, she created and managed the very first national advisory panel of girls serving the department. Jin has worked passionately to communicate girls' issues to difficult audiences. She has spoken at numerous conferences and events, including the International Congress on Women's Issues, contributed to books such as Our Bodies Ourselves, published in 2005, news articles, and worked with the media to create positive messages for girls. Furthermore, she serves on advisory committees to global, national, and community organizations to empower women and girls. Jin holds a BS from Trinity University in San Antonio, Texas, and a Master of Public Health from the University of California, Berkeley, where she also studied mass media communications. Next, we'll have Sarah Leah Whitson, who is the Executive Director of the Middle East and North Africa Division of Human Rights Watch. Previously, she has worked as an attorney in New York for Goldman Sachs and Company and Cleary Gottlieb Steen and Hamilton. She has conducted numerous human rights missions in the Middle East over the past 15 years, including the Center for Economic and Social Rights, Harvard Study Team, and International Study Team missions, examining the impact of war and sanctions on the Iraqi civilian population, the international human rights law, Group's election monitoring mission in Kurdish-controlled northern Iraq, and a fact-finding mission in southern Lebanon for Madre. Sarah Leah Whitson has served on the boards of the Armenian Bar Association and the New York chapter of the American Arab Anti-Discrimination Committee. And we also have Andrea Bartoli, who is a senior research scholar at the School of International and Public Affairs at Columbia University in New York, the director of the Center for International Conflict Resolution, as well as the chairman of the Columbia University Conflict Resolution Network. He works on regional conflict resolution in southern Africa, the role of religions in conflict resolution, and learning organization in the field of conflict resolution. His recent publications include Somalia, Rwanda, and Beyond, the role of international media in wars and humanitarian crises. Andrea Bartoli has a BA from the University of Rome, Italy, and a PhD from the University of Milan, Italy. Trained as an anthropologist, Bartoli has been actively involved in conflict resolution since the early 1980s, particularly in Mozambique, the Sudan, Burundi, and Angola. So we'll ask each speaker to speak for about 7 minutes, and then we will have a long time for question and answer from the audience. And I'll invite Andrea Bartoli to be first.
I was the last to arrive and the first to speak, the last to be introduced, the first to address the audience. I'm very pleased and happy to be here. I apologize for the slight delay, but the subway express train was not working and I didn't calculate the... The two questions that were offered to us as panelists for this address of 7 minutes, which I think it's just an indication of the time we are living. Conferences are becoming shorter and shorter, and clearly the exchange is becoming faster and faster. It's the MTV of conferences, I think. It's this sense of, you know, the pace is becoming, you know, definitely quicker, and it's a good thing in many ways. What is the long-term strategy for improving relations between West and Islamic world? And the second, are the West and Islamic world on the right path? So on these two questions, I have clearly a passionate response. The first is that instead of speaking about strategy as one, we must speak about strategies as a plural. And the reason for that is because I think that one of the key points of the conversation between the West and the Islamic world is exactly on the unification principle. Where are we going to unify the understanding between two worlds that are clearly many within? To speak about the West is just ridiculous. It just doesn't exist. The West exists only in relation to something else that is East, or in relation to something that is north, or something that is south. But the West, as a cultural concept, is as divided as the Muslim world, as the Islamic world, if not more. So the idea that there is this unifying principle that is able to keep together the West is just phenomenal. Many of you may be aware that in New York City, in September 11, 2001, there was an attack, and that a few thousand people were killed in a spot, in a moment. Well, some in the West responded with a very strong sense of honor and duty, going after the one that were perceived to be the enemy who did that. They went to Afghanistan searching for enemies. They went to Iraq searching for enemies. This is one phase of the West. In the same West, families of those who lost their dear one in that attack, some of them, not all of them, but some of them, many of them actually Christians, as the West is supposed to be, decided to form an organization called September 11's Families for Peaceful Tomorrows. What did they do? They went to Afghanistan, they went to Iraq, and they looked for victims' families that, as they did, look for a solution different from a violent response. They found them everywhere. They found them in Palestine, they found them in Israel, they found them in Afghanistan, they found them everywhere. Everywhere they found families that after being attacked, after having a loss in their own family, a brother, a son, a daughter, a husband, a wife, a mother, killed by a violent attack, turn to a very different strategy. They reached out, they look for alternatives, they try to build for themselves, by themselves, in themselves, with themselves, a peaceful tomorrow. Well, is this the West? Is this Islam? How does this relate to the conversation between the West and the Islamic world? I think it relates a lot. It relates a lot because it tells us that the supposedly unity, the supposed unity is not there. And when leaders try to do what President Xanana, the president of East Timor, the first president of East Timor, the first president of independent East Timor, after a long time in Indonesian jails, said a few months ago when the East Timorese crisis was again on the verge of a catastrophe, he said, speaking about his own leadership and about the leadership in East Timor, sometimes we scare people when we are unable to address problems intelligently. Beautiful sentence of Xanana Gusmão. Well, this is a strategy that tries to create unity. To create unity with one simple strategy, which is to identify the enemy. I'm a Catholic. I'm a devout Catholic. I try to be one. And one of the saints that many Italians are very fond of is Caterina da Siena. She was a lovely woman who was very forceful, very impressive. She had a personality. Probably many of the students here, I can see that the female presence is quite large in the conference and in the speaking sector. Many of them probably have this firebrand quality of Caterina. She was speaking to the Pope. She convinced the Pope to go back to Rome. She was very forceful. Well, she had an idea of union, an idea, a vision of union for Europe, to unify all Christian powers, all Christian princes, all Christian kings, and to have one Europe. Well, her way of doing this was to fight a new crusade, to go against Islam, to use Islam as the enemy. Well, that's a strategy in which you do have a clear West and a clear Islamic world. We are enemy, we are opposed, we get energy from one another because we clearly define one another in differences. I wonder if that strategy is really reasonable, and also if that strategy is just real. Where is the space for September 11th Family for Peaceful Tomorrow in that strategy? Where is the space for all the ones that do not find themselves in the unity that comes from enmity, but find themselves in a different kind of unity? For example, the unity that human rights discourse is trying to articulate. A unity that is based on the human common family, the common humanity we all share. Well before being of the West, well before being Islamic, we are just human. And therefore the unity that we want to articulate is actually before the differences that some wants to see as the basis for the partial unity or the hostile unity that the use of enmity necessarily requires. So in that sense, I definitely think that the West needs to look into peaceful tomorrow strategies with great interest. Because a minority within the West is saying enmity is not a solid enough basis for a conversation. If you construct your conversation with the Islamic world through the lens of enmity, you are going nowhere. You are going to have a confrontation that may last much longer than the one with the communist world. Communist collapse, Islam is still alive. It was not only a victory of President Reagan, it was a victory of anyone who believed in something larger than a human project. The communist collapse saw the emergence of very deep-held religious belief in many, many areas of previously controlled Soviet territory. So the battle with Islam by those who are looking at this through the lens of enmity is going to be long. The West, in that sense, has, as Katerina, confronted Islam for many centuries. Is this really the strategy that we want to pursue? Do we really think that the best legacy we can get from our own heritage is the legacy of the Crusades? That the best legacy that we can get, especially in this country, a country that was born out of the desire to experiment something different than the religious intolerance that Europe was experiencing long ago. I definitely think that America has an important role to play in this conversation. And in a curious way, it's a role that requires a self-understanding that goes back to its root. America has been plural since its very beginning, and has consistently won its internal battle when the forces of intolerance try to control the life of the government and the society, imposing restrictions and exclusivity. Quakers in the United States were killed and executed. Massachusetts killed Quakers because they were, I don't remember exactly the title of the accusation, but fundamentally they were disturbing public order. They could not be, preach, they could not express their religious belief. And that brings us to another point. And please stop me when I'm close to the 6 7.
You're finished up, if you can.
Okay. I'm sorry. I was taking away. But just the final point is that necessarily we need many strategies because the tensions are not just between the West and Islamic world, but within the Islamic world and within the West. Quakers were killed by intolerant Protestant mainstream Christians in Massachusetts. Americans left Europe because Catholics were killing Protestants and Protestants were killing Catholics. And in Iraq, most of the dead are actually Muslim against Muslim. The same is in Sudan. So the tensions are not just between the West and the Islamic world. They are within. And my strong suggestion is that the more we refer to our common humanity, the easier it will be to find correct strategies. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I know it's difficult to stay within 7 minutes. It's a very short amount of time. But next we'll have Mr. Idris.
Thank you very much. Welcome. I'm impressed on a Saturday that so many people would turn out for such a subject, so it's great. I'm going to try and stay to the 7 minutes, and I'm really quite interested in the conversation people want to have afterwards. So for those of you who have participated in a lot of these kinds of conversations, I don't think that anything I'm going to say is going to be news. I agree completely with how Professor Bartoli started out, which was simply underlining the inadequacy of using these terms to divide the world. These are both internally incredibly diverse communities. You're talking about the West and the so-called Muslim world, and there's extraordinary overlap when you look at the sizable minorities in the U.S. and Western Europe of Muslim populations. You look how many people from the U.S. and Europe live in Muslim societies, And in any event, when people talk about the West, oftentimes they're sort of talking about the dynamics of globalization that are oftentimes sort of attributed to the West benefiting from them more than others, and not so much to geographical locations. So the terms are poor, but when you have to capture something in two words, I'm not arguing with the organizers, that's what you've got to do. I think that the issues that are driving discord between the U.S. and predominantly Muslim societies are really of two kinds. I think there was one set that is political in nature, and there's another that is popular, person-to-person in nature, one of mutual understanding. And depending on what you think is most important, depending on where your sphere of influence is, depending on what you enjoy doing, you can work in either of these areas, and I encourage everybody to, because, frankly, we need more than we have today, working constructively in this field. On the political front, I have the honor in the work that I do now of reporting to what's called a high-level group of sort of very eminent people. And one of them is Archbishop Tutu. And I had the pleasure of having a conversation with him about this where he underlined this, and it's much more impressive coming from him than me. So I will relay it to you. He said, you have to understand that much of what everybody's talking about in terms of the Muslim world and the West are really dynamics that are causing extraordinary resentment, frustration, and anger among much of the global population, particularly in the developing world, towards the double standards in how international law is being implemented. That there is an extraordinary view throughout much of sub-Saharan Africa, much of South America, much of the Southern Hemisphere in general. I think you'll find this also in the North. It's not just a Southern thing, but it's particularly acute in the South and in developing countries, that the same political powers that are making the rules for international relations are also selectively enforcing them, and in fact ignoring or violating them whenever those rules do not happen to match with their parochial national interests. So it's not okay to torture people, it's not okay to abduct people, but if you're torturing people and abducting people and you have the political power to do so without being attacked yourself, then it's okay. This is, whether you agree with that statement or not, I think a very strongly held view, not just in the Muslim world, but in much of the world today, around who gets to violate the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty and who doesn't, about environmental regulations around when democracy is supposed to be a good idea for societies and when democracy is subverted for societies, because the people who would come into power if democracy was allowed to reign are not the people who particularly Western governments want to see in power. So these kinds of double standards are pervasive, and on the political front, they have to be dealt with somehow. I'll get to possibilities later. At the popular level, sort of the person-to-person and mutual understanding, how do we know each other level, the picture is also quite bleak, I would say. The Gallup organization did polling in the U.S. and asked, you know, what do you most admire? What do you admire about Muslims and Islam? And the largest response they got, 33% said nothing, and 22% said, I don't know. So you have more than half the American population that was polled by Gallup, and Gallup is pretty, I think they're about as credible as a polling agency gets. You had over half the American population essentially saying there's either nothing to admire about Islam and Muslims or we don't know. Incidentally, the next highest response was the sincerity of their religious belief, which was the highest response among Muslims when they were asked, what do you admire about Islam and fellow Muslims? Anyway, in terms of the worldview or the view of the West in the Muslim world, there isn't as much of a sort of across the board, I don't know or I admire nothing. In the polling that Gallup has done, which they say represents 1 billion Muslims, they're doing it every few years in 10 predominantly Muslim countries, they found that people admire the hard work ethic, technological advances, and political freedoms especially. They tend to detest the policies, particularly of the United States, the foreign policies, particularly of the United States. But at that sort of popular-to-popular level, it's slightly different. So, you know, if you want to work at the popular level, the person-to-person level, the mutual understanding level, the kinds of things that you're already doing here and the kinds of connections that are made between predominantly Muslim societies and societies in the West, I think are fabulous. Because the more you have those contacts, the better you get to know people, the better you get to understand people. Now, there's some things working very hard against you in that realm. The first is particularly since September 11th and everything that's happened since then. There have been a lot of regulations and laws passed that make it quite difficult for people from predominantly Muslim countries to get visas to come to the States for as students or in a number of different capacities. So that makes it quite difficult. And there's a group called AEA Consulting here in New York. I forget what AEA stands for. But they did a survey of cultural exchanges. And of all the cultural exchanges that are funded in the U.S., the largest percentage of that funding, it's a little over 30%, goes to cultural exchanges with Europe, American-European exchanges. The region in the world that has the smallest number of exchanges, smallest percentage devoted to it of funding for cultural exchanges is the Middle East. I don't want to perpetuate the notion that the Middle East makes up the Muslim world. As people, I hope, know, the entire Arab world is less than 15% of the global Muslim population happens to be Arab. But the point is, I think we probably, as Americans, need to understand and try to be understood in predominantly Muslim societies more than we need it with Western Europe, although we also have some problems there. But so you're looking at, there's some obstacles to the popular level, and you have these difficulties of sort of the view of double standards at the political level. Now, extremists on all sides of this issue play very well on these dynamics, okay? So when you have extremists in predominantly Muslim societies, they will speak very much to the policy frustrations and the angers. They will talk about Palestine, they will talk about Chechnya, they will talk about Iraq, and they will also talk about a certain view of Western society as decadent, sex-obsessed, anti-religion in general, these kinds of things. Now, in the polling of Muslim societies that I've looked at that I find credible, Gallup again, Pew and others, when they talk about the policy level stuff, they get a big resonance. In predominantly Muslim societies, that resonates. With me as a Muslim, it resonates, even though I was born and raised here in the States. And I think you'll find with the majority of Muslims, the policy issues resonate when people talk about that frustration. The stuff about the decadent West and all this, frankly, does not resonate with predominantly Muslim populations nearly as much. It's sort of another sort of piece of baggage that's brought on by the most extreme fringe of Islamic extreme Islamic movements, but it doesn't have nearly as much support. But they play on one in order to advance both agendas. And I happen to think that in Western governments, you also have some extremists who play on the ignorance of Islam to build up the notion of an Islamic threat, to get policies advanced and to keep populations in fear so they can do what they would like to do. It's not a huge conspiracy theory. It's basic politics, and every society does it. I don't think it's something unique to the United States. I think the unfortunate thing here in the States is that, whether you see this as unfortunate or fortunate, the world is no longer, you're no longer playing in a world where things can happen over there and they don't have repercussions back here and vice versa. I actually think that's a fortunate thing. We are living in a more interdependent world, and that's not just a catchphrase. It used to be a nice way to think about how you deal with people when you think, well, I'm really tied to this person in the audience and, you know, we have some common humanity. But now that's actually real, in my view, in terms of how international economic systems work. What you do in your country over there may affect my economy here. How you deal with immigration may affect my economy here. My health now depends on what you do about foot and mouth disease or about any number of things that with increasingly porous borders. Now even my physical security is to some extent dependent on how secure people in your country feel, particularly the most prone to violence in your country. If they feel under threat and they think I'm to blame for it, they can visit that violence upon me. In that kind of world, if you see it as a luxury, I really don't, but nobody has the luxury to act in purely unilateral ways, because at the end of the day, it's self-defeating. Win-lose approaches in a world where you're all in the same boat is essentially self-defeating. And I don't think that that's a catchphrase anymore. I think that's the reality. We don't know how to deal with that. Americans don't know how to deal with that. Europeans don't know how to deal with that. No one knows how to deal with that really effectively at the governmental level, because that's not how politics has been played since the beginning of time. But that's where we are today, and we have to catch up quickly. Am I done?
I think so.
Okay. We can get to possible recommendations later.
Yes, please ask about possible recommendations. I think that's important to note on. Next, we'll have Ms. Mira.
Thanks. Is this on? Yes? Okay. So anyway, first of all, thank you very much for inviting me. It's really an honor and a pleasure to be here. I started working for the State Department in the months just after September 11th, and I have to say I was trying to once get an article published in a periodical, and the periodical said, never start any article that you send to us in the wake of September 11th, and so I started my speech this way. I'm like, great. But anyway, I did start working at the Department of State in the months after September 11th, and I remember very distinctly that our military was going into Afghanistan, and we would wake up in Washington, and that one of the Taliban ambassadors who fled to Pakistan was having news conferences every morning in Islamabad. And he was making accusations, terrible things, about what we were doing, that we were bombing hospitals, that we were killing children, and all kinds of things which generally turned out to be untrue. But they played across the world. They played across the Muslim world, and they played across Europe, and as we slept. And often, when we woke up in the morning, people already had these impressions of wrong things cemented in their minds. And so I joined the State Department because I believe we face no more important challenge today for our own national security than to foster common interests and values and to confront common threats together. So, like everybody else, one of the topics I was asked to speak about today is long-term strategies for relations between the West and the Islamic world. And to be totally honest, it's a strategy that actually requires revamping our entire diplomacy from the ground up. So, I mean, it's quite a task. So we're very busy at the State Department. But this is because during the Cold War, there was a different dynamic. We were trying to get information into societies that were largely closed, where people were really hungry for information. But today, in many Islamic states, as you probably know, that there is this huge information explosion. And what we're competing for now is actually for the attention and credibility in a time when rumors can spread across the world, whether or not they are true, where fact or fiction can spark riots in a matter of seconds. So you may have heard of Secretary Rice talking about this new diplomacy. It's called transformational diplomacy. If you're not familiar, please allow me to quote. She says, "Transformational diplomacy is rooted in partnership, not paternalism, in doing things with people, not for them. We seek to use America's diplomatic power to help foreign citizens to better their own lives and to build their own nations and to transform their own futures." Now, I think when people think about diplomacy, I have a feeling that the first thing that comes to people's minds is fancy receptions. Now, having been to many such receptions, let me just share with you that they are not that great. The food is awful. You have to wear really uncomfortable shoes. And, I mean, the bottom line is nobody is going to solve the Iran nuclear issue while trying to balance a drink in one hand and also trying to eat a shrimp cocktail. It's not, you know, so. But transformational diplomacy is different. It's an elaborate name, but it's a simple concept. Diplomacy is not just about words. It's not just about speeches or conferences or meetings. When the United States helps to train police in Benin, that's diplomacy. When we fund a literacy program in Morocco, when we fund an HIV clinic in Nigeria, when we do microcredit programs in Afghanistan, these are all examples of transformational diplomacy. I do have to add that our diplomacy actually involves the entire world. And I have to confess that I viewed this topic, the strategy for long-term U.S.-Muslim relations, as kind of a trick question, because really, there is no one-size-fits-all diplomacy for the Muslim world. Our strategy in Indonesia is going to be different than our strategy in, say, Iran. So obviously, there's a range of diplomacy options that we choose from every single day, and there's no one-size-fits-all. The other thing I want to stress is that diplomacy is a process. It takes months, it takes years, it takes generations. And therefore, a critical part of our long-term strategy is to reach out to youths. So I very much appreciate the statistic, and I think it really does demonstrate where the State Department is trying to go, that 30% of our programs are towards Europeans, but we're trying to build that every single year. We fund and implement many programs right now to promote international youth exchange, and they're growing every day. We're bringing children from dozens of Islamic countries to study in U.S. high schools. And like the changes of the past, the new efforts today are not going to be completed tomorrow. They will take time. And this is more sort of off the cuff, but just being here and listening to people and where they're from, I do have to say that it's your work too. It's not just the government's work to do transformational diplomacy. It's very inspiring to be in this room, to be honest. It's very inspiring to see people who are so have so much intercultural understanding, who have such diverse backgrounds, and who are so committed to these issues. So really, I mean, in whatever capacity, I really am excited to see people so interested and hope that you'll consider careers in government, because we really need you. I mean, we really need you. They're, it's, anyway, I mean, I'm saying this like, it's just, it's very exciting. It's very exciting to have young, dynamic people coming into the government. And I mean, we depend on you. You guys, I mean, for the most part, Americans, we need young Americans very badly at the State Department to help implement these goals and visions that we have. Transforming the State Department is the work, it's the work of a generation. And it's urgent work. We're totally committed to it, and it's not going to be deferred. The other thing is, even if you don't seek out a career in government or whatever, every American who travels or who works or who takes a trip has an opportunity to represent our country. And you can represent us well or you can represent us poorly. It's a choice that we make. And really, a lot of the way that the world looks at us is affected by the way that they think we look at them. So I don't know if you've ever heard of Karen Hughes, but she's our top official for public affairs and public diplomacy. And she likes to tell a story about an Egyptian woman who said to her, "You think we're all terrorists, don't you?" And I mean, she was horrified. She was like, "I don't think that." She's like, "Why would you think that?" But really, this woman thought that because you see things like Dubai Ports World, and you see some of the rhetoric that comes up in situations like that. And sometimes that is the message that's communicated to the world. And so I think all of us, from the government and from society in general, we have to be very conscious of everything that we say, because as we speak in our public debate, people listen. So the second question that I was asked to speak about today is whether or not we are on the right track with regard to Western-Muslim relations. And I know that there are skeptics. We're all familiar with the Samuel Huntington's Clash of Civilizations theory, right? If not, Huntington hypothesized that, quote, principal conflicts of global politics will occur between nations and groups of different civilizations, and that the fault lines between civilizations will be the battle lines of the future. So it's all very ominous, and many people point to Western-Muslim relations today, and they say that this is the clash of civilizations. It's happening right now. But as President Bush has pointed out on numerous occasions, when it comes to the common rights and needs of men and women, there is no clash of civilizations. The requirements of freedom apply fully to the entire Islamic world. The people of the Islamic nations want and deserve the same freedoms and opportunities as people in every nation. Now, maybe some of you thought I was rude because I brought the newspaper up here, but I brought it for a purpose because I was reading just a couple of the headlines, and I see General Faltz Marine response to Iraq killings, three held overseas and planned to bomb Hudson tunnels, battling the resurgent Taliban. I mean, I was at the Gallup briefing, and seriously, is it any wonder, is anybody surprised that what Americans have to admire about society, Muslim society is nothing? When you look at this, is anybody surprised? I mean, this is the message that comes every day. And so, but the thing is, when you look in this room, I could name hundreds of reasons, hundreds of things to admire about Muslim society. So clearly there's some kind of a disconnect going on here. And so consider the idea of clash of civilizations for the following examples. In the past 3 years, we've concluded 5 free trade agreements with Muslim states, including Morocco, Oman, Bahrain, United Arab Emirates, and Malaysia. President Bush's Middle East Partnership Initiative has devoted more than $293 million in 4 years to reform efforts so that democracy can spread, education can thrive, and economies can grow. In 2007, we will bring over 700 students from a dozen Muslim countries to study in the United States for a year. And that number has almost doubled from last year. So these are just the tips of icebergs. Muslim states are our friends. They are our allies. They are aid recipients, they are military partners, they are training partners, they are trading partners. The clash of civilizations, as it relates to the Muslim world, is a myth. It's a myth that is propagated by the people who have the most to gain from seeding conflict. It is propagated by terrorists. It is propagated by enemies of Islam. It is propagated by enemies of the United States. It is in the interest only of these people to perpetuate that a clash of civilizations is among us right now, and that true Islamic beliefs are fundamentally at odds with Western values. When we buy into that idea, all we are doing is endorsing a mentality that the Islamic world and the Western world cannot peacefully coexist. And I have to say, sitting in this room, we know that that's not true. So more and more people, including more and more Muslims across our world, are speaking up and are saying that. And I think it's very important that we empower the voices of our fellow Americans to join us so that our diplomacy can be a success. And I'll close with another anecdote from Karen Hughes. She recounts that while she was in Afghanistan, she met a young woman who hoped to write a book someday. So Ambassador Hughes offered to say something on the girl's behalf because she was writing her own book. And so the woman's answer through her translator was quick and unequivocal. She said, women should be able to go to school and to go to work and to choose their husbands. And she was 13. So when the question is posed, are we on track with the Muslim world? I really find it exciting and inspiring to look to the hopes and beliefs of women like that young girl, because serving for the State Department, it is both our privilege and our duty to help her and to help others like her to live in freedom, and that duty extends to the entire Islamic world and beyond.
Thank you very much. Next, we'll have Ms. In.
Okay, I also want to thank AID for having me here. It's really a pleasure and an honor, and I almost feel like this was done on purpose because I have the greatest job in the world. I do get to work with girls all over the world. But on the way here on the subway, I noticed a woman who had a tattoo, and it was a Chinese symbol that had love and peace. And to me, that pretty much sums up what I hope to articulate. And I'm going to sound probably a little bit more idealistic than, I don't know, I haven't heard from, but idealistic than most people here. Exactly. But at the same time, I did do what she had recommended and did work for the executive branch. So I feel like I've did my dues. So the two questions that was asked, and I'd like to address the second question first. It says, the question that we were asked is, are we on the right path? And you could probably already figure what my answer is going to be. We are on the right path. If you could just look at history, there was a time when there was no United Nation. There was a time when women could not vote. And there was a time where a lot of things couldn't happen. So I only see us working towards in that direction. But at the same time, I do think that we do need to address a lot of underlying problems, which is poverty, oppression, and hopelessness. And I'd like to quote William Bendley, who is the Secretary General of World Conference of Religion for Peace. And he quotes beautifully, but I'm going to paraphrase because it's quite long. And he said, peace is more than absence of war. Peace is broken by violence, bad governance, disease, and abject poverty. And when I was asked to speak on this panel, I wanted to bring the women's perspective. And I don't have to tell anybody in this room, I know everyone's very intelligent, that the poverty impacts women the most. So of the 3 billion people worldwide that lives less than $2 a day, 70% of them are women and children. But when we look at war, it's also a very grim statistics that over 450 wars have been recorded due to religion. And in just 2005 alone, we've spent $1 trillion on military spending. So how does this translate to poverty? Well, for instance, China purchased 26 combat aircraft from Russia, which could provide safe water for all of its people for 1 year in China. In India, ordered 20 fire aircrafts from Russia, which could provide basic education to all girls who cannot attend school. And in Iran, 2 submarines from Russia, which can provide essential medicine to Iran several times over. So this is the reason why I love my job, because I am a passionate advocate to make opportunities happen for particularly girls, but also women worldwide. And I do think this is a great platform or a medium to bring together, because I also don't like the title, but I know you don't have much choice, because I believe in comparing apples to apples. If we're really talking about Muslim and Islam, then I think it should be Judeo-Christian, although I realize we're trying to be very sensitive and politically correct, probably in especially in New York City. I just recently moved to D.C., and I realized that there's definitely a different world. But if we are talking about the religion per se, then I do think that there's some commonalities. I know that from talking to my Muslim colleagues and women friends, they do, and of course this isn't, I hate to generalize anything, and same thing with Judeo-Christian as well, but they do feel oppressed, they do feel that they are subservient to men, and they do experience violence, polygamy, rights of property. But at the same time, this isn't anything that's foreign to Judeo-Christian. As a matter of fact, if you just look at Catholicism, it's been exactly the same. Even our Abraham had many wives. So I think this feeling, and of course, I'm not here trying to compare to religion, but I do think that because of certain feelings that women can come together, and especially girls can come together, and work on common peace building. And so what is a long-term strategy? I think for me, it's speaking the language. I've been fortunate enough to travel a lot and live abroad, and I love languages. And I think learning language has taught me literally and figuratively that we all need to speak the same language. And I don't just mean language. I don't mean from Spanish to English. I mean, where do they come from? Perspective, meeting them where they are. And many times, you know, even within, it's interesting, I'm also the liaison for UN, and I don't have to go to UN to see UN. I walk outside and look at New York City. It is UN. So to me, is what can you do to understand your fellow human man? Just people and women. And just the people in this room, it is so diverse. So I think, you know, I challenge you to look back and see what can I do to make this relation better. And also I noticed I wear it and I see that you guys are passing it out. So this peace bracelet, it symbolizes a lot of things, but it symbolizes that we all need to speak the same language. But it also, to make this complete bracelet, it takes all these different parts. So I do believe in this world that it takes all of us to work together. And once again, as I said from the beginning, and probably I am very idealistic, is that now I'm seeing phenomenons that I've never seen before, and I don't think we've seen in the world. When people give their own profit, regardless of motivation, people like Bill Gates and Warren Buffett, who are giving their worth not to their own children, but to do global good. So to me, I do think we are working in the right direction. Now for Girl Scouts USA, we are also one member of a bigger organization, and it's called the World Association of Girl Guides and Girl Scout. And our goal is to build girls of courage, confidence, and character to make the world a better place. And to me, I think it's interesting. I don't actually even know how she found out, but just to be on this panel, I got contacted by the Pakistan Girl Guides, and she said she wanted to congratulate me for moving to New York. She also wanted to know if we can do something to work together, to bring our girls together. So that's just one thing that happened from announcement of this forum. I have no idea even how she found me. I don't even know how she found my email. But I guess going back to what someone on this panel had said, that it is a small world. Information is cheap, but to me, knowledge is power. So what are you going to do with the knowledge that you have? And I could probably go on and on about efforts that we are trying to do within WAGS and Girl Guides of bringing girls together, whether it's a summit to understand one another, understand each other's culture, but at the end of the day, what can you do to help your fellow country? It isn't just about my country. Because as Thomas Friedman said, if you don't go visit bad neighborhoods, they may come to visit you. So, and going back to the number two question, I'd like to end that this isn't something we haven't seen before. In history, Lenin tried to produce a perfect class, and Hitler tried to produce a perfect race. I don't believe in creating anything perfect. I believe in accepting us for who we are, but trying to understand one another. And I'd like to end with the quote that Winston Churchill said. He said, "To build may be the slow and laborious task of years, but to destroy can be the thoughtless act of a single day."
Thank you. And next we'll have Ms. Whitson.
Answer the first question, are Islam and West on the right path? No, they're not on the right path at all. Really, the question is how to improve Islam and Western relations is really, really what we're talking about, is how to make the people of the Muslim world, the people of Africa, the people of Latin America, the people of Asia, and most of Europe less pissed off at the U.S. and the U.K., because really that's what we're talking about. I think the answer for improving relations, as at least one panelist hinted, is to rely and try to use as much as possible a human rights framework, a universalist framework. And that means encouraging the West, and really when I say the West, I'm talking about the U.S. and the U.K., to address the various human rights crises in a balanced, even-handed, and neutral way, and also to encourage the Muslim world to address human rights issues in a balanced, neutral, and even-handed way. Because the charges of hypocrisy and double standards are made in both directions, obviously some with more devastating effect than others. But nevertheless, focusing first on the U.S. and the U.K., the U.S. being, of course, the bigger partner. We can't talk about the question of what's wrong with relations between the Muslim world or the whole world and the United States without talking about Israel and Iraq. The U.S. is not focused or interested in the human rights of Palestinians. The U.S. is not acting as a disinterested party in the conflict between Israel and the Palestinian people. And that has, as I think we all know, really, really upset most of the world. The U.S. can change this. The U.S. can act as probably the only one who has the power and the influence to help reach a negotiated solution between the warring parties. But first, it's got to stop supporting the human rights violations of Israel. It's got to stop funding Israel and Israel's continuous constructions of settlements in the occupied territories. It's got to end funding Israel, which of course is the number one recipient of U.S. aid, to the extent that Israel uses that aid to construct a wall inside the occupied Palestinian territories and with significant, serious effect on the basic human survival and existence of the Palestinians. And the U.S. has to express a stronger voice when Israel uses excessive and disproportionate violence to counter the threat of violence and the violence that the Palestinians, of course, have been directing against them, as we've seen most recently this past week in Gaza. I think as part of this, we have to confront the role of the Israel lobby in shaping U.S. policy on this matter, because it's not a good one. It hasn't had a positive effect in terms of the U.S. taking a balanced, even-handed, neutral approach in this conflict. Next, Iraq. I think the U.S., again, can improve its reputation, its credibility, its voice, its reputation by coming clean about Iraq. And really doing what the United States is best at, I think, which is recognizing our mistakes, making amends, and punishing wrongdoers. I think we need an independent investigation to confirm the falsehoods on which this war was based and advertised to the United States. There have been a number of commissions that have looked at this, but none authoritatively, none completely, to examine the record as to why the United States made the decision to go to war against Iraq, again with huge impact on the human rights of Iraqi civilian population. The United States might consider an apology to the extent that we just got it wrong, or the U.S. government just got it wrong about the reasons for the war, particularly in light of the fact that there are over 100,000 civilians killed in Iraq and over 2,000 U.S. servicemen killed in Iraq. The U.S. might end impunity for U.S. forces. We now know that there have been numerous, multiple cases of deliberate killing of Iraqis, Afghanis, Pakistanis by U.S. forces. And even when there have been, in the few cases where there have been military commissions and military tribunals, courts, martials against them, the penalties, the punishments have been so mild as to really disappoint people that there is a justice system that works in the U.S. and punishes wrongdoers. And the United States should close Guantanamo. I'm not just saying this. The whole world has said this. Even the U.K. has said this. It's really hard to base a foreign policy on human rights and democracy if you're not basing your own policy on human rights and democracy. And Guantanamo stands as an incredibly embarrassing, damaging example of what's wrong. The third aspect of this is the United States should more sincerely live up to its words of promoting and wanting democracy, particularly in the Arab world, not so much the Muslim world, but in the Arab world, and stop supporting tyrants that are not interested in democracy. Egypt is a great example of that. When the United States did speak up a little bit last year to temper President Mubarak's actions, he responded. He allowed even cosmetically a competitive presidential election. There was some opening in the parliamentary elections, and as we know, a large number of Muslim Brothers, over 80, were elected. And I guess that was too much democracy, because the United States has since backed off, and Egypt and Egypt's government has since resumed quashing demonstrators, violently beating journalists and activists, imprisoning judges, and anyone who dares to criticize the government. And yet, the United States has not cut aid to Egypt. The United States has not stopped being being the number one funder for Egypt, and of course Egypt is the second largest recipient of U.S. aid. So really, it's not just talking about democracy, it's about not helping tyrants who suppress and oppress democracy in the Middle East. With respect to the Muslim world, again, we turn back to the double standards and the hypocrisy. I think the Muslim world is doing itself a huge disservice by its willful ignorance of the atrocities in Darfur. Whether in Darfur or in other places, I've spoken to many Muslim government officials, Arab government officials, as to why it's not their priority and why it's not on their agenda, and they see it as a politicized issue. And what I always say to them is, well, don't let it be a politicized issue. The Muslim world has to be at the forefront of talking about the problems in the Muslim world, the human rights problems in the Muslim world, because if they don't, then other people will, with different agendas and with different results. So you need to come to the very front of that and say, this is my issue, and we have to solve it. The second is by stepping up to the plate and condemning attacks against civilians, whether the civilians are Israeli or whether the civilians are British or whether the civilians are American or so on or so on. Too often in the Muslim world, there's a willingness to say that, well, Islam doesn't permit attacks and Islam is for peace and so on. But when an attack happens on a bus in Tel Aviv, there's absolute silence from not just the government leaders of the Muslim world, but the civil society leaders, the journalists, the writers, the poets, the artists, the actors, the activists. There's rarely a word, virtually never a word of condemnation of attack that deliberately targets civilians. And again, this is having a disastrous effect, playing right into the hands of the people who want to encourage this notion of a dichotomy, of a conflict, as was alluded to, much of a bogus dichotomy and conflict between Islam and the West. Because if you look in the Islam, I know, you all know that in many ways it's as Western as many parts of the United States. And if you look at the United States, obviously we have a large Muslim population growing every day. It really is a dichotomy that needs to be rejected at all measures at all times, because it is a bit of a propaganda campaign, and it does really sow division as opposed to bring people together around common principles. Thank you.